Okay, thanks for coming and welcome to all of you, my most loyal attendees. So, today I'm going to deal with three key concepts in relation to Hindu diaspora, but some of the points that I might raise probably may actually apply to most diaspora situations, whether it's Indian in general or Hindus in particular. Mm. So I'm kind of, the initial part of my talk would be trying to raise these generic kind of points, and then towards the end I'll try and link with the Hindu diaspora specific sort of situation and see how it turns out. I have given some of the definitions of ethnicity there from Sebastian Poulter. One of the key points that I need to emphasize here is that all these definitions were kind of developed in the context of legal framework. You know, in order to actually deal with certain specific cases in the court of law and so on. So legally, what does ethnic or ethnicity refer to? All these three definitions that I've given, I can just quickly run through and then make my point. The first one pertaining to nations, you know, as opposed to not Christian, Jewish, Gentile, heathen, pagan, etc. The second one, in other words, it's a very early definition where they called, they used this term for everybody else other than Christian, Jewish, etc. The second one is pertaining to race, or peculiar to race or nation or ethnological. And the third one is pertaining to or having common racial, cultural, religious, linguistic, etc. characteristics. Now, all of these have problems in dealing with legal cases. In other words, the first one is, of course, is pretty archaic and cannot be used. The second one is pretty superfluous. It doesn't really capture very much. And the third one is too broad, you know. So legally, in front of the judge, you know, how is he going to kind of use it to kind of address a particular case? And that's the problem. So Poulter actually argues that ethnic identity is a malleable phenomenon, and cultures can employ, cultures can be obviously employed, mobilized, or manipulated, or modified to suit strategic purposes. And he gives a case in point that in the census of 91 in Britain, when for the first time the category ethnic was introduced, the Arab people of Arab origin indicated that they were white. And this rings a bell for me in South Africa. Back in as far back as 1890 or so, the Gujaratis and Parsis in South Africa wanted to be listed as white, not as Indian. And so they distinguished themselves from the indentured Indians and tried to, you know, form part of the European community because of the sort of slightly sort of better, fair complexion and what have you. So what he is trying to suggest is that there are strategic purposes as to why people choose one or another sort of identity marker. So what is considered ethnic can change depending on circumstances and situations. So there are a few examples that I've given there. So for this reason, T.K. Ooman, I didn't have the reference in front of me, but I have his article in my library. but I could give it to you later on. He, in his work, tried to separate the notion of ethnicity from nationality and citizenship, because these form actually separate criterion and therefore need to be understood separately. Da Silva suggests that these two terms, that is, nationality and citizenship, have emerged as privileged categories of collectives, collective being, in the 19th century. He says that the nation is a collectivity of cultures, which are in effect the, quote, embodiment of modernity's cultural principles. What it constructs is a culture of a people, which in Hegel's formulation is nothing other than the concrete activities of the transcendental subject. We know from Hegel's sort of work, the notion of transcendental subject for him was basically an articulation of or a production of cultural sort of variables. So the notion of race, on the other hand, is based on an understanding of natural laws about cultural diversity. Now, again, all of these terms are pretty loaded, and they mean different things, again, in different places and different contexts and so on. And people can actually deploy them, you know, for various strategic purposes. Craig Calhoun argues that national identities are not necessarily inherited from the past. There is a whole debate as to how people actually invoke past in order to somehow make the point about their present identity markers and so on. Now, whether it has anything to do with their past or not, people always do that. I think there is an implicit assumption that somehow the more ancient it is, that identity, the greater the power and validity it has in making the case. In other words, we are that in that time, and therefore it's important for us to claim that, you know, linear kind of heritage. And all religions actually do that, and in their own, you could actually see that in cosmologies, actually. You could see that in Hindu cosmology, and you can see that in the Jewish cosmology or Christian interpretation of the Jewish cosmology and so on. Just a quick case in point is, since most of you understand Christianity, let me use that example. We know the arrival of the people of Israel into the land of milk and honey, the Canaan, out of Egypt. And through those, you know, subsequently in the biblical text, in Deuteronomy, in the Kings and Chronicles, and right up to the prophetic text, you have this notion of Yahweh as the tribal God and then eventually appearing as the universal God. The question is actually raised after they arrive in the land of milk and honey. And the question is, who is this Yahweh that brought us into this land of milk and honey out of Egypt? And the question is answered in the Genesis story. And this is the Yahweh who created the entire universe. So by kind of somehow going all the way back to the beginning of universe, so they were able to claim their connection to Yahweh, and therefore their identity as, you know, so powerful, as a unique people, chosen people, and all of that. You could see that in the Hindu cosmology, in, you know, virtually everywhere. I mean, why do we raise this whole thing often in the context of Babri Mosque dispute? you know, how old this site might have been, and so on. Whether indeed there was anything really or not, it's important for those people, for political strategic purposes, you know, to raise those ancient, kind of invoke those ancient connections and so on. So Calhoun says that it is as though analysts imagine that there was great cultural creativity in tribal and agrarian societies, but that moderns wield only the capacity to homogenize or manipulate, but not to create and create differences. In other words, there is again this assumption that somehow tribal societies are more homogeneous and they create sort of homogeneity and so on, and modern societies are, you know, they create differences and so on. Again, is problematic. This view, he says, I think, is one that early moderns helped to produce by the way they revered the classics and the way they understood historical time, reason, and the struggle against prejudice. But it is false, he says. He gives a few points about ethnicity, and which I thought were very informative. He says that differences among groups are not simply inherited from pre-modern cultural forms, contrary to the usual assumption. Secondly, it is a product of confrontation among people of different group identities. Thirdly, it may have existed in the pre-modern world with religion as its main ascriptive construction, but it has flourished and constructed anew in the modern rise of cities. And the parenthesis is mine, actually. I might add that the rise of globalization and migration has actually accelerated that construction. So, according to Calhoun, this construction of ethnic identities, even though people invoke the past, it has more to do with the present and present problems and so on, rather than the ancient identities that really existed or not existed. Who knows how homogeneous it was. What distinguishes the modern identity formed around ethnicity is that it is not based on individual placements in society, but the places to which the individuals may gain access and in which they may wish to settle are melting fast and can hardly serve as targets for life projects. In other words, the reason why people often, as in the case of that Arab people of Arab origin claiming to be listed as whites, it's a strategic kind of goal. In another context, they probably would choose to be listed as Arabs or then Muslim or, you know, etc., etc., Iranians or Iraqis and so on. So it changes. Bowman argues that people construct more than one identity and they are constantly exploring new identities. Therefore, he says, I quote, "Perhaps instead of talking about identities inherited or acquired, it would be more in keeping with the realities of the globalizing world to speak of identification, a never-ending, always incomplete, unfinished, and open-ended activity which we all, by necessity or by choice, are engaged." I think that seems to me is a crucial point, because it's not so much of identity, because it is shifting from time to time. The British Hindus here, whether they are Gujaratis or whether they would want to be identified as Hindus in broad sense, depends on where they are and in what relationship they are to the people or to the society that we are talking about. Today, the notions of ethnicity, citizenship, and transnationalism are understood mainly in the context of globalization. Therefore, scholars such as Michael Bodman speak of ethnicity being cosmopolitanized, the role that electronic media has played in transforming these identities is important. Boardman says, quote, "What the new media have indeed accomplished is a continuous infusion of new ethno-national cultural influences from abroad. For example, Indo-Trinidadians is a case in point as to how the Bombay-based films have transformed their identity into re-Indianization and re-Hinduization." In other words, in their own, similarly in the case of South Africa, which I probably know better than the case of Trinidad, in the 60s and 50s, probably didn't matter very much whether they are this or that. Suddenly with the rise of communications between India and South Africa in the late 80s, suddenly, there is somehow a resurgence of, you know, Hinduization of their identity, or Indianization, you know, depending on, again, which meeting you are present at, you know, whether it's a purely Indian businessman sitting and talking about Indian business issues and so on, or whether it's a cultural organization, or whether it's a religious organization and so on. So the issues are different.
Aren't they often in response to other groups? I think you mentioned before Africanization. Once one group starts to go through this process, then it's automatic almost. The response from other groups will be to go through the same process to establish their own identities.
Yeah. So it's certainly in response to, first of all, the broader majority society. In the case of South Africa, it will be the African community. Here it would be the European society and so on. And then, you know, all the other variables will come into place. One key word in the context of globalization is the idea of, or the notion of flow. It has to do with the flow of capital, people, material goods, information, and so on. It indicates a paradigm shift in cultural studies, a move away from this, from study of fixed objects to processes, often blurring all boundaries. In other words, in the past, for instance, the Orientalist scholars from here, for instance, studied fixed texts, classical texts, and they could construct a kind of Hinduism, a kind of India that they thought was available to them through these texts. But with the changing circumstances today, with the kind of information flow that we have, a whole number of other variables come into play that kind of call into question as to how we have constructed India, for instance, through these texts. You know, you could study art, for instance. You could study archaeology, you can study architecture, you can study anything and construct a kind of understanding of that society through those means. But with the diversity of information that we now are capable of receiving, we simply cannot depend on any one source, because it becomes a continuous process of how we then use this massive data that's, you know, flooding into our computers, into our homes through TV and all of that. It changes how we then construct, because even disciplinary boundaries then get blurred. You know, at one time we could talk about simply anthropology, history, sociology as unique, separate disciplines. But today, if we are talking about the diaspora, you have anthropologists there, sociologists there, historians there, religion, specialists there, all kinds of people, including economists, politicians, policymakers, you know, bureaucrats, everybody. So Featherstone says the concept of flow points to movement, mobility, to speed. And that's very important, the speed at which we receive this information. Volume. On a daily basis, I'm getting nowadays, I don't know how to stop this spam. All kinds of, you know, you have won this, congratulations, you know, winning notice. You have won $25 million, you know. I don't know who sends these things, but, you know, it's flooding my computer. And intensity of interchanges in globalizing world. The implication for social and cultural life is that the intensity of global flows helps to establish new connections and patterns of association and social relationships, along with new modes of identification. One of the results, as shown in Apodora's work, is that this flow of information, flow of migration, etc., results in the construction of what is known as imagined communities. I think this is very important in, for instance, in Apodora's work. He argues that it is this imagined community that actually mark the difference in the way they link with issues across the globe. I mean, people from Britain could identify, Hindus from Britain, for instance, could identify with issues somewhere in Canada or somewhere in India or Delhi. They have a sense of not a concrete, the old sense of territorial Indian, but rather what he calls a deterritorialized Indian. In other words, they don't have any territory, they don't have any geographical sense. They move from here, their capital, tomorrow to any place else. So the money changes. I mean, they could be chucked out of East Africa today and they end up here. Suddenly they are boom, you know, big businesses here. All they've done is move their capital from East Africa to Britain. You know, they're a big deal again. And if the time again is in favor of them in back in East Africa, they'll move their capital back again, you know, depending on the political changes and so on. Often ethnic conflicts are fueled by these imagined communities, says Apodora. This potential to sustain imagined communities means that localities are influenced by events distant in space and time. Distant people see themselves as having a stake in each other's lives, as we find in the case of Bosnian Muslims, who were under pressure from Islamic forces in Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Egypt, who felt they had a legitimate stake to reconstruct Bosnian Islamic identity, more in line with their own perspectives. The issue whether in the context of globalization there is an independent role for culture is a moot question that divides the works of both Apodora and Jonathan Friedman. I think in the case of Apodora, he sees a central role for culture, how these imagined communities invoke and make deploy culture to construct their identities and so on. But Friedman, on the other hand, sees all of these identity constructions as part of a larger world system process, somewhat in line with Wallerstein's world systems theory. So for him, it is not so much what is happening just now in the current period, but there are other things happening you know, in the past, and everything is connected. There is a process. For instance, he sees that in two phases. Like, in, you know, at some point there must have been a homogenization process. You know, if you look at the tribal societies, small village settings, and so on, people are very homogeneous. You know, the rituals they perform and the kind of things they do, and so on. And then as they move into subsequent periods of urbanization and so on, the homogenization becomes problematic, and then they get dehomogenized. Also, it is in line with the hierarchical structures of hegemonic and dehegemonic structures. In the small tribal village context, societies are very hegemonic. There is this strong hierarchy of social relations and so on. And in the urban spaces, such hegemonic relations collapse. Of course, there would be other types of class connections and class structures and so on who would develop, who probably would control. Like last night, there was this documentary, the BBC documentary of the millionaires. 1% of global, you know, sort of population controls really our lives. You know, they are the multi-millionaires, billionaires, and so on. They have the, you know, invisible control on our lives, what we do and how we, what we purchase today, and all of these things. So it actually has its own kind of hierarchies in modern Europe. So it moves from hegemonization to dehegemonization, you know, and it's like a cycle. It goes on, according to him. It is here, according to Featherstone, that Friedman raises the question whether there could be transnational or transcultural identities or cultures. This, in the argument of Friedman, occurs only when the identification process, not identity, but identification process, is transcultural, that is mixed, or occurs on a level above the nation state and not between them. In other words, when the identification is beyond the nation state, in other words, it's like the for Hindus to be transnational, the identification process must be not just between British Hindus and Indian Hindus, but rather an identification between global Hindus across nation-state boundaries. In other words, from somebody from New Jersey is able to link with someone in South Africa or Britain or Delhi, anywhere. So, and their reasons for that connection is other than simply religion or culture or whatever. There could be whole other reasons, and they are capable of linking, you know.
But if you call them Hindus, then that's their common link, isn't it?
Yes. And that's what I was suggesting earlier, that cultural component, Hindu or Indian, whatever, is deployed to manipulate, to...
Sure.
To mobilize.
But what can be trans beyond that?
Well, it's the nation.
To link them, I mean.
It's the it transcends the national boundaries.
Sure, but they're still Hindu, and they're linked by a common perceived identity, whether it be real or not.
Yeah, but it is transnational, though.
Sure.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. In other words, it's not like Hindus linking with Hindus, but it is. In a particular location, but it is
the links are linking with Hindus, but not confined in geographical space.
Yeah, it's transnational. In other words, the question is here whether we can now talk about transnational Hinduism.
Yeah, but it doesn't make any sense because it's still Hindu, isn't it? I mean, well, all right, you're getting rid of the spatial confinement, but nevertheless, these people see themselves as a small link community. I mean,
along
globally, they're still
along ideological lines. You know, Hinduism, exactly, for instance, can provide an ideological backup.
Sure. Yeah.
That's probably the identity. But the point that they're raising, the social sciences now are concerned about whether, unlike the earlier identities, you know, Hindus are seen as like, you know, this connection always to India, you know.
Sure.
And it is now no longer just to India. You could be connected to, say, Norway, you know. And you, I mean, like South African Hindus, for instance, now go on pilgrimage to Mauritius,
mm-hmm,
not to Bombay or not to, you know, Benares and other rivers in, you know, India and so on. They go to Mauritius on Shivratri festival.
But it's a Hindu.
Yeah. But it's no longer sacred space in India, but it's sacred space is moving transnationally. So the identity then, yeah.
But again, I think you said last time, in fact, what they do is transpose the Indian landscape onto wherever it is, whether it be Mauritius, and it's happening here as
exactly.
well.
Yeah.
So in a sense, India is no longer a space, a physical, it's more an imagined
space.
That is transnational, if you like, but nonetheless it's the idea that's important, the ideology.
It's an ideological kind of backup that needs somehow, that comes out of that Hindu kind of thing. But there could be several denominations within that Hindu fold, and they overlook those. And for business purposes or for marriage alliances or whatever it is, they somehow connect themselves, you know, through alliances and all kinds of business partnerships and so on. So people from Los Angeles, New Jersey, etc., can link up with anybody else in Britain, London, and so on. So Hindu identity can move from national boundaries, you know, either within British kind of national boundaries or Indian national boundary, but it goes across. So that's, I think, the one of the serious points about this issue is the current developments around international politics, as to sometimes how dangerous these connections are in its in their implications. In other words, people can actually, by virtue of being connected transnationally, perpetuate conflicts in a particular national context.
Sure. But I mean, they are linked ideologically, which is far more powerful.
Yes. But I think the ideological connection is simply a kind of a sort of a justification for their involvement. But I think they see more strategic, you know, sort of things about issues there. In other words, the say for instance, the global organization of people of Indian origin, Gopio, for instance. Now, the reason for its emergence in the last, say, 10 years or so, is essentially to, in the face of globalization, in the face of concentration of capital in Europe, among European companies, European multinational companies, and so on, the Indian stakeholders came up with this brilliant idea how to move capital among Indians. And so they were talking about an Indian bank, Indian Airlines, not the Indian Airlines, Air India and so on, but in Indian Airlines they were talking about. You know, huge Indian kind of structures, really.
Yeah.
Everything
it's
about
like
around
network,
India.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So I think this becomes a worrying factor internationally, because if that actually is screwed up, then you will have, you know, in some business sense, you can have those. I mean, it's probably okay, you know, to have these links, but you could actually manipulate those structures in crucial times of history. When, say, for instance, the case in the context of terrorism, for instance, I mean, you could use that to manipulate events in Gujarat, manipulates events in Babri Mosque, you know, scenario. You can manipulate anything by simply controlling these, you know, resources. And you have powerful people all over the show. And they have enormous resources, media. I mean, you can bombard, I mean, like, say, you can imagine this Sikh guy sitting in South Hall listening to this video sort of messages or radio tapes and, you know, the bhajans and so on, without having to be in Amritsar. He's experiencing that powerful kind of cultural identity. And naturally, that is enough for him to, in the event of any onslaught on Golden Temple or any political development there, you know, you can stir up this problem here and garner this support here and generate the momentum that people in India, the Sikh community, would need. And that's exactly what happened in the 1984-85 scenario. It's the Sikh community in Canada and Britain, everywhere else, that actually fueled the crisis, you know, that the government of India had to deal with. So, you see, the people locally are probably not very rich, but they have resources from other places. You see, that changes
it's
everything.
It's like the fear of transnational corporations, isn't it? That they can, in fact, override, say, governments. Or
And these transnational people have no faces. You can't see them, actually. You know, their money has no territory. Their, you know, strategic plans have no territorial reference. You know, they can make plans, like, say, Lever Brothers can make plans for their company, regardless of what happens in Britain or in UK, I mean, in America or in South Africa or anywhere, because they have a hand everywhere, you know. Toothpaste, Colgate toothpaste is sold everywhere. You know, everybody buys that today. Who produces it? Lever Brothers. So, you know, that's such an ordinary thing. So they actually determine how you brush your teeth, what paste you use, you know, what cream women can use, you know, all the cosmetics that they bring out, the shampoos and all kinds of things. Whether this phenomenon of transnationalism has occurred in the case of Indians in general and Hindus in particular is probably a moot question again, but Stanley Thambaya seems to think that it has. Like Friedman's idea, Thambaya's idea of transnationalism also works along the lines of connections beyond the homeland of origin. He says, transnational connections linking diasporas need not be articulated primarily through real or symbolic homeland. Decentered lateral connections may be as important as those formed around a teleology of return. Instead of a teleological desire to return to homeland of origin, the transnational diasporas, quote, reproduce and maintain themselves over time through marriages of, between persons located elsewhere in other diaspora communities or in their societies of origin through sharing cultural knowledge and receiving visiting priests, artists, and so on and so forth. Issues of gender, race, and religious discrimination can engender transnational responses from Hindus in other parts of the world in an effort to assist their fellow Hindus elsewhere. Therefore, issues of, for instance, whose interpretation of Hinduism is most persuasive among British Hindus, the question that Kim Knott deals with in her book, may be a local British Hindu concern, but it can ring a bell for some other Hindus elsewhere, in New Jersey, for instance. Similarly, public policy issues around racism in Canadian society vis-a-vis Hindus there can also engender a response from other Hindus elsewhere. So the issue of transnationalism among Hindus, or for that matter Indians in general, has to take into account a multidimensional concern. On the one hand, Hindus living in Canada or South Africa or Britain may wish to think of themselves as citizens of those countries in the first place, and their ethnic origins in that context take secondary place. In the context of reproduction of their various traditions and customs and inventions of rituals in the host country, they may thrive on their affinity and proclivity for their places of origin. And in the context of broader issues of public policy, trade, flow of capital, and so on, that characterize globalization phenomenon, there is an attempt to forge links with global Hindus elsewhere. It is perhaps in this sense Hindus in diaspora are citizens, ethnics, and transnationals, depending on the situation.
It's very much what you're saying. It's like conspiracy theory, isn't it? You know, the way you talk about it, it sounds like it's like the same things they said about the Jews, for instance.
Mm.
You know, that they were transnational, they weren't. That they formed like a club or exclusive brotherhood across the world, and you know, manipulated economies and political decisions. It, you know, we're moving in that, into that sort of area, that sort of direction, aren't we? And it's the Hindus this time, or it's the Muslims, or it's.
I think, yeah.
I think it's a moot point.
Yeah, it is. It is actually, they may not actually in the initial periods do it deliberately with an intention to kind of manipulate and harm that particular economy and so on. But in the context of conflict and crisis, they can then deploy those and divert those energies into areas that they would like to, and then channel those in a very concerted way.
I was wondering if you saw maybe this event as a broad word, but as perhaps some form of progress, the idea of, again, you know, constructing identity, but always kind of trying to go beyond a specific geographical area. So the idea that, you know, perhaps an ideological idea, you know, as Hindus, not just Hindus because we pertain to the land of India, we Hindus in idea, you know, as a concept. So it's kind of like, do you think this is a perhaps an idea of progress, that there is progress in the sense that it reminds me a little bit of the idea of that Houston, I think,
Houston
had.
Smith.
Yeah. About the idea, you know, it's always better, first we identify with our family nucleus, and then for those who can expand beyond that, they identify with their village communities. Then you go to the country, and then to the whole, you know, universe. Perhaps if you can embrace that. But do you think perhaps this is gonna, this can be envisaged, you know, from that line?
Yeah. Yes and no. In the sense that you see, the identity is somehow. The point, for instance, I think. Who was it that I was, Calhoun, for instance, making was that you can make, say, for instance, a broader Indian identity claim if you are faced with some other, you know, people. But then you are Gujarati, you are, say, you know, within that, say, Kathiawadi, etc., etc., then it comes down to those narrow boundaries.
You're still a Gujarati in South Africa or Canada, right?
You could be, but then within the Gujarati community, then you might end up talking about whether you are from Kathiawad or Surat or, you know, those other considerations play their role. So, in other words, it depends on these variables. And people, I think the point that he's making is people choose to choose the card that they want to play, depending on the circumstances. And they might actually feel sorry for having played a particular card if the situation suddenly changes. Oh, I should have actually, you know, considered myself as this, not this. You know, these things actually, because the context is so fast changing. That's the crucial thing about the globalization process. Things are so fast moving that your identity is constantly fluctuating as well. And people are playing politics with their, you know, identities. In other words, they are this today and they are this tomorrow and so on and so forth. So I might meet somebody in London tomorrow and I talk about my identity as something else. And I move to California or somewhere, I meet somebody else, you know, it changes. So this is the point he's making. In other words, there is no certainty about one's identity. It's political, it's social, it's economic, all kinds of consideration. And so here in this context, for instance, Gujaratis coming from East Africa, you know, they have among themselves, from the outside, for us, they all may be Gujaratis. But then when they meet in the temples and shrines and so on, they start talking about, are you from East Africa, are you from, you know, India, and because it has to, at some place, to do with the marriage alliances, caste, sub-caste distinctions, gotra distinctions, you know, denominational distinctions, and so on and so forth. And somehow, even if they couch under various things, people somehow have subtle ways of detecting them, knowing, you know, who is who. You know, the accent, you know, the mannerisms and the rituals, something gives up. And so you know what's going on. And these are subtle politics that people play. And people sometimes get into embarrassing situations by being in the company of somebody and then suddenly trying to extricate themselves out of it, you know. At one level you may think it's all right to eat with this guy, and suddenly somebody else walks in, and then you wonder why you are sitting with this guy, because now the other guy sees you. So you're not supposed to be in company with this guy, you know. So then suddenly you are trying to change your identity and see what happens. The most awkward moment that I have known, not personally, but I don't know how many of you know George Hart from Berkeley. He teaches Tamil. He married a girl from Madurai. His wife is a Tamilian, 100% Tamilian, Madurai, Mudalayars actually. They are vegetarians, but you know, in the broader context of caste, you know, there are all kinds of distinctions. So he and his wife went to Madras one day, for a vacation or something, and then they had a Brahmin friend, professor of Tamil in Madras University, who invited them to have lunch at a restaurant. So the two of them pitched up, and they already were seated, and then this guy hasn't come up yet. So half an hour went, 1 hour went, he never pitched up. And then the next day, they then had their lunch and then they went away. And then the next day he met them and he said, look, I'm awfully sorry I didn't pitch up, because as I was coming to the restaurant, at the doorstep I met this man, and there is no way I could have had lunch with you, because in terms of my caste ritual rules, it would be impure to have lunch with you, because you're a European and I can't. So, you know, he shifted his identity immediately. So this kind of thing, you know.
If he hadn't met him, he would have.
Yeah. If that guy didn't pitch up, of course, if he pitched up in the middle of his eating, that would have been another scenario. How he would have extricated himself out of it, God knows. But, you know, that actually tells us something as to how crucial it is for people to play these identity roles. you know, each time in different ways. It would have been perfect. I mean, Ramanuja's wife played this game. You know, she fed Ramanuja's teacher, and after he left, she cleaned up the entire house. And Ramanuja comes, and he says, "I wanted to eat with my teacher. What happened? Why didn't he come?" He said, "Oh no, he came and he ate and went away." "No, no, no. You were supposed to have kept him here until I came. And so where is he?" "No, he ate and went away, and I threw all those all that food, leftover everything." Then Ramanuja rushes to that place and he extricates that food and he eats.
He says, "Who's the teacher?"
The teacher is a low caste person, Nambiar. And so, although he was from a low caste, Ramanuja considered him as superior because of his, you know, status as the teacher. So he learnt all the Alvar philosophy tradition from him. So he invited him to lunch one day, because for him the most important thing that he wanted to do was to establish. You see, in those days, the teacher and the student had this intimate connection, and the, you know, what the modern anthropology calls substance code. The teacher and the disciple have to exchange fluids. That's important in order to actually engage in that personal relationship. So Ramanuja wanted to eat the food that was left by his teacher. So he invites him. And then his wife, you
would
know.
Would the wife have served him if her husband had been there with the teacher?
No, what she did was she knew that the teacher was invited. So Ramanuja goes out to fetch something. So in the meantime, she sends a message to the teacher asking him to come and eat his food. So while Ramanuja was gone, the teacher comes and he eats and he's gone. But the teacher knew what was going on. So that's why he actually deliberately and consciously came earlier, because he didn't want his Ramanuja to eat his food. You see, the teacher was conscious of the caste rule. So he never wanted to break the caste boundary. So he was aware of that. Although he was his student, but the student was superior to him, so he was playing along with the according to the caste rules. But Ramanuja was wanting to go beyond the caste rule and break the boundaries and eat with him. Not only eat with him, but eat his food. In Telugu we call it ingili. You know?
Leftovers.
The leftover. It is not just the leftover. What he left in the leaf. Not the leftover food in the dishes, but the one that is actually on the leaf. That's what he wanted to eat. So, you know, it's interesting how these things actually tell us, you know, the identity issues. And, yeah.
This is a small thing. In the about the story about the restaurant, when I came in and it was an issue, wasn't the fact that they were eating in the restaurant at all an issue?
Well,
strict about these matters,
well, yeah, it is an issue. It is an issue, but I think this person, this Brahmin professor, who invited, this is a vegetarian restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
To that extent, it was all right. And it's nowadays not very uncommon for, you know, Brahmins and with all the this thing, to go and eat in a vegetarian restaurant. I mean, there are certain exceptional kind of things that they override. So if you are actually going with a family, you know, your whole family, and you eat and so on, that is, you know, in strict terms, it's not allowed. You know, it's still, you know, not, you know, in Telugu we call antu. You know, it's not sampradaya. But, you know, he's waiving that, you know, kind of restriction. But then he thought he will get away by not being noticed by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he was spotted at the door, he couldn't escape. He kind of quietly, you know, went away.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, George and his wife, they understood what was going on. So, you know, it was kind of funny. And, of course, he took it in a lighter kind of sense, but like a joke. But you could be offended. I mean, you basically, you see, in another sense, he actually did something that is also not according to his own sampradaya. You know, he actually insulted the guest. And that also is not okay with his sampradaya. But then, again, you have to marry these two evils, you know, which is, you know, the purity and pollution is probably much more important for him than insulting the guest. So he could go and apologize. But the other thing, you know, he would be, you know, in strict sense, he could be excommunicated. But of course, it doesn't happen nowadays. But, you know, that's how extreme it could go. If word spreads around that he's eating with all the mlechas and all that, you know, his status in, they won't excommunicate, but his status kind of gets lowered slowly. And then people think less of him. Oh, he's kind of, you know, loose man, you know. And then you kind of, you know, you're no longer holding the same authority. Like the other day, Ashiana was, Ashiana, do any of you know this American girl who is studying with us now? She has a classmate who is a very orthodox Brahmin from Andhra Pradesh, and her parents established themselves in Boston area as very orthodox family in spite of being in Boston, and he is well respected in the community. And now she goes and meets this other Telugu boy, but not Brahmin. And she's in love with him and she wants to marry him, and then the parents don't know. And she's terrified of telling the parents because the father definitely will throw her out. Because for him, if this sort of is known in the community, his status in the community is all built on his orthodoxy. You know, so the extent to which he could sort of command the respect of the community depended on the orthodox position that he takes, his whole lifestyle, purity, all of those things. He's the head, kind of almost like the leading chairperson of the temple, everything. So if somebody knows that his daughter is going out with this other boy, then his status is gone. So his status is far more important for him than his daughter's future.
Victorian Christianity.
Yeah.
It seems that the motivating teleology then is just really pleasure and social status. From this perspective, at least.
Yeah. I think he's, in this case, I think he probably prioritized his own kind of selfish sort of approach to his status and his respect and so on. I think sometimes they don't realize that he could use that same status to change things. What if he went to the temple committee, you know, the elders and so on, and spoke about the possibility of people marrying across the caste boundaries and so on, and then, you know, we see these things happening on these, you know, Oprah show and Dr. Phil's show and all of these things, that American talk shows. You know, how people suddenly come out from the closet and tell the billions of people on national television, international television, what happened to them. Up to that point, they probably felt, you know, they were like, you know, what happens if I say it? Once they said it, people actually invariably have a positive response to that than negative response. I mean, people understand.
Our younger daughter has a professional colleague who's a young seacorman, a good fellow in the English school, and he had a very strict convention. He did, in the end. You know, she went about it as delicately as she could. Thank you.
wedding, you said many of these things with us, mixed with guests.
I mean, people don't realize how therapeutic it becomes when someone like that comes out and makes a public statement. And that's the transformative power they have. Somehow they don't use it and think of themselves, as you rightly say, the pleasure of enjoying that status, rather than thinking about the welfare of the next generation, the daughters. I mean, the daughter is actually going through a trauma. I mean, like, she's petrified. She's one of the best students in the country, and she's in medicine. And her younger brother is like this, whiz kid who could answer any, quiz on the television. He was on several television programs, I believe. So they're like this popular family, very intelligent, very, high profile, this thing. So this father is afraid if this kind of comes out, his whole status collapses and so on.
Oh, this
may not.
Very much exists even in India.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very, very common.
I have comment on that issue, and then I have question, which is kind of completely different. The comment is on this, like a marriage, and then like orthodoxy, things like that. This is to me, I mean, why is that necessarily better if his father, orthodox father, allows her daughter to marry with the, some boy with a different caste? Why is that necessarily better? Because it seems like everybody here takes it for granted that it's better, like casteless society is sort of inherently better. But if you consider actually the purity is important value, then maybe it is the case that the father, because he thinks about the daughter's purity, and then for him, that's the higher than the sort of Western egalitarian kind of value system. Therefore, he thinks that's better for her. So that could be the case. That's my comment. Indeed, I would think that actually her sort of intelligence, or like her brother's intelligence, might have been coming from the purity of family. I think that's the idea of purity that actually, that's my comment. My question is, completely separate thing, is that, do you think, this Hindu's diaspora situation, somehow contribute to the universalization of the idea of Hinduism? Which means somehow now Hindus in UK or in Canada or South Africa, because they're so all over the world, kind of start thinking, well, actually Hinduism is kind of, in a way, beyond region and beyond sort of ethnic conception, therefore might be applicable to other ethnic groups, like white Europeans. Or still the concept of Hinduism pretty much sort of sticking to somehow other the people of Indian origin?
Yeah, I think in terms of global movement of people and so on, certainly the notion of who is a Hindu has substantially changed. Certainly, first of all, in the context of, say, for instance, South Africa, where caste has no real meaning. I mean, there are names that are associated with caste. That's about it. You may have the last name as part of the caste. But other than that, their sense of Hindu-ness has very little to do with the old ritual kind of complex social relationships and so on, where social hierarchies are organized along the lines of ritual, you know, hierarchies and so on. So in the absence of those structures, because those structures are no longer, even the extended families are no longer existing in South Africa or even in Britain, it's collapsing. So in the absence of those systems and structures, there is a certain fluidity about the notion of Hindu. First of all, among Hindus themselves, I mean, among Indians themselves. And I think it also has opened up to the possibility of non-Indians being Hindus. I mean, in other words, you have now Hindus in European societies. Now, are they Hindu, and in what sense? If you then define in the old classical sense of Hindu, having the caste affiliations and structures and ritual purity, impurity, all of those things, then you have you may have a problem using that kind of concept applying to people of non-Indian origin as being Hindu. But there are Hindus, there are people who call themselves Hindus. So who speaks for Hindu? That's the question now. In other words, who is Hindu? So what's that? So I think, in a way, the globalization and this migration patterns, all of these things, the diaspora developments, have radically and substantially problematized the classical notions of what Hindu was. So today, you know, for instance, are you Hindu?
And that raises enormous questions about purity.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, not just...
Not just the Hindu.
Of Hindu you are, but if anybody who isn't born within that system is automatically Hindu, but can't possibly be a Hindu.
Yeah.
So that in itself raises the question.
Yeah, exactly. The old anthropological assumption that substance code is what determined caste relations has collapsed. So anthropologists are now trying to figure out how to now describe caste, how to describe Hindu. In the face of, for instance, Vetterwerk will have, you know, all kinds of different things to say about caste, as opposed to, say, some classical anthropologist who works in Indian, you know, caste-based societies and so on, like, for instance, Mackie Marriott, for instance. So there is a kind of a divide among social scientists as to how to, because everything is still happening, so these, you know, these things are still happening, so social sciences are trying to figure out how to capture these things, describe them, analyze them, and how to explain. So, in a way, to go back to your comment, from that point of view, you know, if you define Hindu in that sense, in that broad category, broad sense, then, you know, there is that possibility for this orthodox person to relieve himself from that burden and consider this marriage, this the possibility of this marriage. But if he then uses the classical old Indian sort of sense of who he was or who he is still in the context of Boston, he probably will never have peace with this situation.
Yeah, but my comment was, well, basically, it's just basically two just completely different paradigm colliding each other. And, well, of course, because we're in West, so we say that whatever according to Western value, if Hindus, how do you say, submit to that value, he says, well, that's good for you, right? But, I mean, why is that so necessarily? I mean, why not, like, Western values submitted to Hindu value, and then, you know?
But I think if you carefully unpack what you said, it may turn out to be a fascist idea of, you know, caste. I mean, that's exactly what Hitler did. I mean, it was based on Hitler's idea of, you know, Europe was basically based on this, you know, purity of the race.
Right.
So racial purity was the basis on which Aryan theory and all of that he developed. So if you want to use that, then you get into all kinds of, I mean, this is what happened to BJP, and you know, they tried to use that. BJP rewrote, you know, the Hindutva and all these movements, rewrote the text, history books. And they even went to the extent of eulogizing Hitler as this Aryan, you know, great figure. I mean, that became, that was when people woke up. Not only the communists in Bengal, but right in the center of Delhi, everybody woke up. Oh boy, this is now going a bit far.
Can't you have, you know, rather than the extremes, can't you have both, in fact, that purity and impurity can be a guideline? It doesn't have to be either or, and in some cases you could overstep, but there are certain rules and regulations, but it's not as extreme as your, you know, polarizing his point of view. It's taking it literally, isn't it, as well.
I mean, there's so many tensions, if you look at any tradition.
It's not taking it like the Muslim reaction. Say, I was thinking, say, the person you're talking about took it, you know, insisted on her point of view. Would it endanger her own personal safety? Would they, you know, would the recriminations just be loss of status for the father, or would they actually try and intimidate, or, you know, to what extent would they, you know, would they try and get cast, or is it much more tolerant in that sense?
Yeah. Well, in this case, we still don't know, because she hasn't gone to the parents yet, so the story has to unfold.
Yeah. Yeah, but actually, yeah, I think that's a good point you made, that, you know, we shouldn't go like extreme, like either or. Because actually, probably the fact that in that so-called Orthodox Brahmin father actually live in the States itself is out of, in a way, context.
Yeah.
So probably he has to make some sort of compromise.
Yeah, he has, to a certain extent, compromised his own status and his own caste rules and all of those things.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes they are they become more orthodox when they leave India, actually, in the face of the other, really. So it's like it's home, you know. It becomes more, you know, it's like the same thing with the Muslim identity, too. I mean, they become more Muslim in the context of Britain than if they were in the Arabia or somewhere else. I mean, you can see the Arab world is looking for American music and all that. You know, once Saddam Hussein was gone, everybody was after this Hollywood movies and music and all that. So it's kind of suddenly opened up a, you know, plethora of other opportunities for them. But the Muslim community on Cowley Street probably is very, very orthodox and very staunch and all that.
Many ways, values and expectations were frozen at the time when many of the families came from 30, 40 years ago. And this is sometimes borne out when, for instance, an educated young bride comes from Pakistan and finds actually she has a lot more freedom and expectation. She would use her education professionally in Pakistan than she has when she comes within
Yeah.
Being out there teaching and doing all sorts of things.
Yeah, I think the elders in the community tend to play the orthodoxy kind of game and somehow contain. I mean, it's the same case with the Japanese society. I had a friend at Harvard, Yoshi Sawai. He now teaches at Tendai University. When he was a single guy in Boston, I mean, at Cambridge, Massachusetts, he was like freelancing and he had no problem. The moment his wife and two kids arrived in Boston, he started talking to me, you know, I'm very worried now. Because his wife is now talking to all these liberated women, white Western women and so on, and she is like exhibiting different kind of behavior, you know, like open, and she is kind of debating and talking, which he never saw in his household. Now, he told me one day, hey, Pratap, you know, I'm worried now. I don't know what my wife is going to do. I must go back. So he was very anxious, actually, to return to Tokyo in a very real sense. So you could see how, because he was, you know, from a very orthodox, you know, the Tendai temple kind of family, he was supposed to be the priest, inherited from his father. But then he became an academic, so he passed it on to his second brother. So his brother became the priest of the temple. So he went into the academic world, but still the family still has that orthodox kind of thing. And the anxiety that he displayed, you know, in my sort of conversations with him and so on, was real. So, you know, that happens in the Western world more than, I mean, and then back in his Tokyo setup, he probably never worried about that, because even if she went and studied higher, you know, further and worked in some other university or whatever, it wouldn't have mattered to him. It was like suddenly in Boston, strong feminist, you know, Harvard Divinity School atmosphere, all these feminist women and talking, you know, equality and all that thing started getting to him, and to it affected. He said, no, this is not what I wanted here. Thanks very much. Yeah. And, I hope to unpack the rest of it in the